And we're going to call case number 21-5038 Cypress Amax Minerals Company versus TCI Pacific Communications. Mr. Steinman, I think you're first.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Steinman, appearing on behalf of TCI Pacific Communications, Inc. I will address the veil piercing issues, which were subject to the cross motions for summary judgment below. Co-counsel Ms. Jansen will then address errors of statutory construction in the district court's interpretation and application of CERCLA. It is a fundamental precept, Your Honors, that veil piercing is a rare remedy to be exercised only in exceptional circumstances. It is only when a subsidiary is subject to such domination of finances, policy, and practices that the controlled corporation has no separate mind, will, or existence of its own, that the veil may be pierced. Kansas law requires that the plaintiff not only prove domination and control so complete that the subsidiary is a mere alter ego, but as an independent prong of the test, show that allowing the fiction of a separate corporate structure, in this case, Tulsa Fuel, would result in injustice toward plaintiff. Thus, the issue before
is that the correct test? Injustice for the plaintiff, or injustice to a third party?
Your Honor, there are different permutations of the language, but the thrust of the cases is that the injustice must be toward the plaintiff rather than just to a generalized injustice to the world at large.
And what case should we look at for that concept?
Your Honor, the case of Delta Innovative Services, Kansas District Court 2017, which states the resulting injustice must be directed toward the plaintiff. Your Honors, the issues before the district court.
You agree, counsel, excuse me for interrupting again, but you do agree that Doughty applies here, the Kansas case?
It does apply, Your Honor.
And so doesn't it say that the injustice is to a third party?
It does use that phrase, Your Honor. The injustice here must, of course, be determined as a separate prong from the alter ego, but it must have a nexus. The issue before the district court here was to decide two things. The first, whether Tulsa Fuel, which was a long dissolved owner and operator of a zinc smelter in the early 1900s, was improperly dominated or controlled by New Jersey Zinc between the years 1906 and 26. And second, and separately, whether injustice or fraud upon the plaintiff resulted. And with respect to both parts of that test, respectfully, the district court misapplied Kansas law. With respect to the fraud injustice prong, the district court was very cursory in addressing it. It literally dropped a footnote and had a sentence in the conclusion that found it would be a fraud or injustice to allow TCI to defend this case now, today's case, on the basis that its predecessor, New Jersey Zinc, was a separate company from Tulsa Fuel.
Well, isn't that a valid identity or identification of an injustice? If you take a position in order to obtain recovery on a claim in the ICC and you make representations as regards the relationship between these two entities, and then come to this court and to the district court and say, no, you can't look at that. Our position's different now. We can say they're very, very different entities.
Your Honor, may I? The difficulty with that is at least twofold. First, it presupposes that, in fact, Tulsa Fuel was the same company as New Jersey Zinc at the time of the ICC hearing in 1923. And the evidence for that, that itself was a misapplication of the law. Secondly, Your Honor,
but can't we look at the testimony and the records that were before the ICC?
Your Honor, the district court was plain that the testimony did not constitute judicial admissions. To the extent that the ITC proceeding can be examined at all, the result very clearly finds that New Jersey's Inc. was the agent for Pulse Fuel and was not the same entity. And to the extent that the court was looking at the underlying transcript, which does involve testimony of a number of people and statements by a number of counsel, the counsel for Pulse Fuel itself said, I do not want for a moment to be understood as maintaining or contending that they are not distinct corporate entities. We're conceding that. But we're
well, they were distinct. I don't think there's any debate that they were looked at, considered to be by some as distinct entities. What we're looking at is whether that is a reality or was Tulsa Fuel an alter ego?
I understood, Your Honor. And the court below, in examining the Dowdy factors, and obviously there are 10 of them, with respect to the financial factors, which by virtue of all of Kansas law are the most significant because Kansas cases do not pierce in the absence of finding that there was an alter ego relationship with financial factors.
May I interrupt you with respect to the financial factors? As I read Dowdy, it contemplates a totality test, a balancing test, that there's no one dispositive factor. And my understanding of your argument is that the financial factors here are in fact dispositive. What is your best case for that? Or what is your support for that argument under Kansas law?
Your Honor, the Yoder case itself discusses undercapitalization, for example, as being the most significant factor. There are a number of cases, Your Honor, which recognize that an overlap, for example, of directors and officers is common. The factors that were found here were either those kinds of common factors, or there was the determination from the district court that the New Jersey Sea could have acted in such a way that it dominated Tulsa Fuel. But there's no evidence that it actually did. There's no evidence that it acted in a way that was detrimental to Tulsa Fuel while at the same time being advantageous to New Jersey Zinc. The findings with respect to the financial issues all found a lack of evidence with respect to financing of the subsidiary, that the subsidiary had grossly inadequate capital, that the parent corporation paid the salaries or expenses. All of those were found to be without sufficient evidence by the district court below. So we would submit, Your Honor, that financial factors are the keystone here that have to be looked at because it's clear that Tulsa Fuel acted on its own. And if I may, Your Honor, I'm just going to give a quick litany. Tulsa Fuel enacted bylaws. It conducted shareholder meetings. It elected corporate officers, issued stock, maintained its own bank accounts, paid its employees, owned property, entered into contracts, regularly submitted annual reports to the state of Kansas, which evidenced its independent financial state. And critically, it paid its creditors at the time of dissolution back in 1926.
Counsel, let me stop you for a minute. Let me stop you for just a minute. Judge Briscoe and Judge Rossman, do you have any more questions for Mr. Steinman? Because if you don't, I was going to let his co-counsel move on.
That's fine.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Jansen.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Each of TCI's CERCLA arguments arises from the district court's failure to recognize that this is a two-site case. There's the Collinsville town site that was cleaned up by Cypress, and there is the separate and distinct Tulsa Fuel smelter site. Cypress cleaned up the Collinsville town site, and it asserted contribution claims against TCI because Cypress believed that contamination from the Tulsa Fuel site traveled from that site and landed or became to be located on the Collinsville town site and caused Cypress to incur response cost.
Isn't that true?
We do not believe
that smelter waste came to the Collinsville area from your smelter?
We believe that not to be the case, Your Honor. And in fact, after a trial on these matters, the district court expressly rejected Cypress's theories, its two theories for how that may have occurred. It rejected Cypress's theory that air emissions could have landed or traveled from the Tulsa fuel site and caused contaminants to land on the Collinsville town site. It found that Cypress had expressly failed to produce sufficient evidence to meet its burden on proving that that was a plausible migration pathway. And it also entered judgment against Cypress on its theory of arranger liability. That is the second liability or theory of liability advanced by Cypress, alleging that.
So there's no theory of liability that there was hazardous waste generated at the Tulsa fuel smelter that came to the Collinsville area, the site, and it came there because, as we read in the record, that citizens of that city used these materials basically as yard materials or driveways or whatever they needed to build around their homes.
Yes, Your Honor. If that occurred, the only evidence in the record demonstrates that that occurred long after Tulsa Fuels dissolved as a company in 1926. And the fact that the district court entered judgment against Cypress on its arranger theory of liability demonstrates the futility and the failure of Cypress with regard to that theory of liability against TCI. So the fundamental, despite rejecting Cypress's two theories for how contamination could have traveled from the Tulsa fuel site to the Collinsville town site, the district court nonetheless went on to enter judgment against TCI on a former owner arranger theory of liability. And it reached this conclusion and entered judgment in this fashion by committing a fundamental error of statutory construction. And specifically, what the district court did is it looked exclusively to the definition of facility in CERCLA without giving due regard for the enacting and enabling and controlling provisions found in Section 113. As the Supreme Court reminded everyone last year when it issued its opinion in Territory of Guam, contribution actions don't exist in a vacuum. They exist only to the extent authorized by statute. Only to the extent authorized by the plain and express text found in Section 113. In this case, that text is found in Section 113 F3B. And that means that the contribution action asserted by Cypress in this case has to have arisen from a common CERCLA liability that was subject to a settlement. That begs the question, what CERCLA liability was settled by Cypress? On the undisputed record in this case, the only CERCLA liability, the only common CERCLA liability that could possibly exist in this case relates only to the Collinsville town site. By collapsing the two
sites. And any hazardous waste that's located there, right?
If there is hazardous waste on the Collinsville town site and Cypress seeks to impose liability on TCI for response costs incurred in responding to that hazardous waste, it must pursue its claims under the set structure found in CERCLA. It has to establish liability within the four provisions found in Section 107. It failed to do so. It had express avenues of relief made available to it under longstanding provisions in the statute and interpretive authority. But what
do we do with the determination by the district court that it could not and no one could sort out the source of these hazardous materials from either smelter? The waste product was the same.
If waste from the Tulsa fuel smelter site is found on the Collinsville town site, it matters how it got there and when it got there. And it's specifically with regard to the arranger theory of liability. That is an intent-driven statutory provision.
So you're saying that is these two, the airborne and the transfer points are the only two ways that the court found that waste came to the Collinsville site. I thought that the court relied on the fact that the citizens of this town literally brought the stuff in.
Your Honor, it ruled against Cypress on its arranger theory of liability that arose.
Yes.
And if it may please the court, I would like to reserve at least a few seconds to.
Why don't you go ahead and finish answering?
Yes, Your Honor. So on the record in this case, even though that was the express theory of how contamination could have found itself traveling from the Tulsa fuel site to the Collinsville town site, the evidence in the record demonstrated that the only instances in which that could have occurred were long after Tulsa Fuels dissolved as a company in 1926. There were indications in the record of a 1936 offsite transport, and there were references to trespass long after Tulsa Fuels dissolved as a company. So it could not support the imposition of a ranger liability because there was no intentional action ever proven to have been taken by the Tulsa Fuel and Manufacturing Company.
Okay, so you're basically saying that because of this timing issue that the district court's conclusion was, I guess, clear error?
Yes, Your Honor. We are saying that after the express failure of Cypress's two theories for how contamination could have traveled from the Tulsa fuel site to the Collinsville town site, it committed a fundamental error of statutory construction to create an alternative theory of relief out of whole cloth. And that alternative means to impose liability on this record is a distortion of the express and plain text in 113 of CERCLA, and it stands in direct conflict with this court's prior decision in Colorado versus Sunoco, because it allows for two response actions to be associated with a single CERCLA facility.
Okay, let me ask you one more brief question, and then I'm going to see if Judge Briscoe and Judge Rossman have a question for you before we wrap up with you. But it seems like on that before the district court, the record, it was difficult for the district court to determine exactly where all of the sources of the contamination on the town site were from. And the name of the doctrine escapes me, but I'm thinking there's a doctrine that says in such a situation that it would be your burden to come show that you didn't have the contribution to the contamination on the town site. Did you put forth evidence that you didn't contribute to the contamination?
There is no way to disprove that on this record. CCI was successful in dismantling Cypress's theory of air emissions, and that achievement is represented in the district court's finding of fact, where it as an entirety rejected Cypress's theory of air emissions as a failure to meet its burden of a preponderance of the evidence that air emissions could have caused contamination to travel from one site to the next. And with regard to the offsite transport, if hazardous waste or smelter material is found in the town of Collinsville, that is an arranger theory of liability. That in the district court was rejected, and it entered judgment against Cypress on that theory of liability. And importantly, an arranger theory of liability necessitates the existence of two sites.
Right. Okay. Judge Briscoe, do you have any questions?
No, not at this time. Thank you.
Judge Rossman?
I do have one question. Thank you, Judge Carson. Counsel, my question concerns your argument that the district court impermissibly expanded Cypress's contribution claim beyond the scope of the original settlement here, really that the definition of facility that the district court, the way that the district court understood that was somehow, the court's discretion was somehow constrained by the ODEC complaint and the consent decree and the first. Can you speak to that a little bit so I have a better understanding of why that's so, why the district court's definition of facility was, by your contention, improperly expansive?
Yes, Your Honor. So by looking only to the definition of facility without looking to the controlling provisions of Section 113, the district court construed and applied facility in a manner that cannot exist on this record. As everybody was reminded last year when the Supreme Court entered its decision in Guam, a contribution action, and specifically a contribution action advanced under 113 F3B, like the one in this case, exists only to the extent authorized by the statute. That means that it can only exist to the extent it arises from a settled common CERCLA liability. The only alleged common liability in this case relates only to the Collinsville town site. And importantly, the connective thread that runs back to this court's prior decision in Colorado versus Sunoco is also found in the plain text of that statutory provision. It speaks in terms of resolving liability as it relates to a response action. And as observed by the Supreme Court in its Guam decision, that's a term of art found dozens of times throughout the statute. Response action has a distinct and express meaning.
Is the Collinsville site a response action or is it a remedial action?
The definition in the statute, response action is inclusive of both remedial and removal actions. And importantly, if it is the action memorandum that is attached to the 2009 consent decree with the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality says it represents the selected remedy, both the removal and the remedial action. And that has to relate by statutory definition, remedial actions relate only to the permanent remedy for a specific site. By collapsing those two sites into one, the district court mixed and matched separate permanent remedies. There is a separate existing ROD for the Tulsa Fuel site. It has its standalone permanent and selected remedy. And the selected remedy for the Collinsville town site was separately administered and selected by the state. Each of those was separately subject to public notice and comment. And so by collapsing those into two, it does great harm throughout the interlocking provisions of CERCLA's enforcement and regulatory regime.
Okay, counsel, thank you. We're quite a bit over. Let's go to Mr. Stowiak. Mr. Stowiak, if you feel like you need some extra time at the end, I'll give you an extra 5 minutes. You're on mute.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the court, I'm appearing on behalf of the plaintiff appellee, Cypress AMAX Minerals Company. Let me start where we really were left off there and provide some clarification, because I believe counsel for TCI overlooked some findings. The question was, did the court find that there was hazardous substances released from the TFM smelter that caused Cypress to incur response costs? And they did specifically find that in finding of fact 61, which directly speaks to that point. In addition, if you look at findings of fact 43 and 46, it's clear that the smelter waste was placed or deposited or came to be located within the area that the district court decided was the facility in this case, and that we incurred response costs as a result of that. And that.
So what was the evidence on the timing? When did the district court say that that waste arrived on the town site?
It didn't specifically said it applied. And your honor asked a great question. What is the theory? Well, it's the theory of common sense, if I may, that if you have two smelters, zinc smelters operating, and the Tulsa Fuel smelter operated between 1911 and 1926, and the BZ smelter operated between 1911 to 1918, operating side by side, right on the edge of the town of Collinsville, and there was common practices that the court found of people picking up waste or the waste coming to be located all around Collinsville, and that's what led ODEQ to want to see the Collinsville soil program implemented. And that's also what was the driving factor in the decision by the court, which is totally consistent with the definition of facility in the statute, consistent with the CERCLA statute, and consistent with the definition of facility in Chevron Mining and other precedents by this court, Seaboard as well. So that
didn't there have to be, I mean, if you want to put the hook in TCI, didn't the district court have to make a finding that their, as to when their contribution might have occurred? Because do you agree that if it occurred after they were dissolved and defunct and no longer doing business, that it's too late?
The court did find that during their operations, there were broken retorts, there were broken cylinders, there was smelter waste, and that smelter waste found its way into the town of Collinsville.
And okay, so there would be, right, in this record, there will be a finding for me to notice that it was during the time of operation.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, during the operations of the Tulsa Fuel Smelter, those materials came to be placed, those hazardous substances came to be placed there. And that's I think 43, 46, 61, and other findings of fact that were issued by the district court after the bench trial here.
And you're saying when you say came to be placed there, you're talking about the Collinsville site.
The Collinsville soil program area, which incorporates.
Okay.
Right. And which the facility incorporates the TFM smelter, the BZ smelter, and the Collinsville soil program area. And I think we have a drawing aerial picture in our brief on that point. And that's consistent with what CERCLA is about. I mean, let me just go back to what I initially wanted to talk about, which is here the district court carefully crafted comprehensive decisions that are fully in accord with the policies of CERCLA, policies and purpose, that are fully in accord with the unambiguous language in CERCLA defining the term facility, that are consistent with the CERCLA precedents of this court in Chevron Mining, Sierra Club versus Seaboard and Farms, and Atlantic Richfield versus American Airlines. They're also fully in accord with the key precedents of piercing the corporate veil, like the Dean case and the Dowdy case, Dean operations case, and Quarles versus Fuqua and Milka versus United Business Communication. As Judge Briscoe noted, those cases all say that the injustice is directed to third persons. And the one case relied upon by TCI said directed to the plaintiff, and then they dropped the other end of that quote, which is, or anyone else. So I think the law is pretty compelling on that subject. And as this court, it's important to understand the policies here. As this court previously stated in Atlantic Richfield versus American Airlines, and I'm sure Judge Briscoe will remember this, as she was the author, CERCLA is a remedial legislation. It should be considered liberally to carry out its purposes. And then in Chevron Mining, this court said, CERCLA was designed to promote the timely cleanup of hazardous waste to ensure costs of such cleanup efforts are borne by those responsible for contamination.
So you're saying if hazardous wastes are created at a smelter, that company goes out of business, that hazardous waste ends up anywhere, they can still be held liable. It doesn't matter that they continue to be in business when the hazardous waste is found and located?
The hazardous waste left the Tulsa Fuel Smelter during the time period. And then the way this works in our case is the determination of alter ego means that New Jersey Zinc and Tulsa Fuel Manufacturing Company are one and the same. TCI admits in its answer to the amended complaint, paragraph 14, that it's the successor by merger, so that the disposal of those materials, which this court found, occurred during the time period 1921 to 1926. If there had been no disposal between 1921 and 1926, then you don't have a basis for formal owner-operator liability under CERCLA. So the other point I want to make in terms of the policy as you think about this, and this is a case that we did not cite in our brief, but I want to bring to your attention. It really speaks directly to what's going on in this case. And that's an opinion that was delivered by Justice O'Connor in the First National Citibank case at 462 United States, 611 at 629-630, where Justice O'Connor stated, our cases have long recognized the broader equitable principle that the doctrine of corporate entity will not be regarded when to do so would work fraud or injustice. The corporate form may be disregarded in the interest of justice where it is used to defeat an overriding public policy. And what's happening here is that TCI is attempting to evade its CERCLA obligations and undermine the public policy of CERCLA, which is to clean up historic hazardous waste locations, imposing retroactive strict liability on covered persons. And they qualify as a former owner-operator of the facility as defined in this case.
Could you help us on the liability connection that we have with TCI? We're told by opposing counsel that you had two theories and you failed on both. One is airborne and one is a ranger liability. If that's true, how come you prevailed somehow? What was the district court's ruling?
My client withdrew at closing argument the ranger liability claim, number one. Number two is their connection here is as a former owner-operator of the facility. The facility includes the Tulsa Fuel Manufacturing Smelter, the BZ Smelter, and the Collinsville Soil Program, which is consistent with the way facility is defined under CERCLA, section 1019 in part B, any site or area where a hazardous substance has been deposited, stored, disposed of, or placed or otherwise come to be located. That definition, just like in Chevron Mining, and just like is unambiguous. So the facility is all of those things.
Is the definition of facility informed, and if so, in what way, by the settlement, the ODEQ complaint, the consent decree? In what way do those documents, I mean, the district court found she knew about them. So in what way did those documents inform the definition of facility, and why was that not improper, how the district court understood them?
No, the district court understood it as proper is that there's a, like in many situations, not unlike Colorado versus Sunoco, where you can have multiple response actions. You had an action. You had a cleanup of the BZ smelter. You have EPA coming in to clean up the Tulsa fuel smelter because TCI refused to do that. And then you have the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality delegated the power by EPA to implement this Collinsville soil program, which was to look at all the materials that came from the two smelters that were existing in the Collinsville soil program. And the court then said, let's look at this holistically and decide what the facility is. And the facility is the BZ smelter, the Tulsa fuel smelter, and all of the Collinsville soil program. That makes common sense in terms of when you look at trying to clean up an area and accomplish the remedial goals of CERCLA. So that's the connection, Your Honor. And hopefully that answers your question. And with respect to the piercing side of the case, the piercing side it's a subjective test. It's multiple factors. You don't have to have the proof of all 10 of the factors. Here we proved a number of those. I think it was four factors. But the most compelling part of it is, and what the central part of alter ego and piercing the corporate veil is, the domination and control of the subsidiary by the parent. And here we have sworn testimony prepared in advance and submitted to a federal agency, the Interstate Commerce Commission, where the New Jersey Zinc said unequivocally that in fact and in constant practice, it manages and directs the operations of its subsidiary companies, including Tulsa Fuel Manufacturing Company, without regard to corporate lines of separation, and constantly exercises its authority in behalf of all of its subsidiaries in any and all matters. If I had an opportunity to craft a compelling basis to pierce the corporate veil and find all ego liability, I couldn't do better than that. That is out of their mouths. And the injustice is, as Judge Egan found, is they can't say that to the Interstate Commerce Commission, which was contemporaneous with the operations of their smelter, the Tulsa Fuel Manufacturing Smelter, and then go forward. And when they're faced with CERCLA liability here, try to say, no, no, it's not us. We don't own the stock. We didn't dominate and control, so forth. The judge systematically went through each of the factors, looked at it carefully. Some of the factors, she went against us. But the reality was, she found that that was the domination and control, that they were the alter ego. And just to clarify, because I think we've heard a couple of different things, Judge Egan ruled that the airborne pathway, there was too much ambiguity about it, and that was not a pathway upon which she based her decision. So that's not even part of this appeal here. So in essence,
but at bottom, the basis for liability goes back to owner operator of a facility.
Yes. Former owner operator of a facility. They're a covered person. There's been releases of hazardous substances into the facility, and they are required to pay for their fair share under contribution. If we've cleaned that up consistent with the national contingency plan, it was necessary cost of response. And in fact, the court found all of those things in walking through it very systematically. The other thing I want to just remind the court of is the Tenth Circuit has one of the most clear delineations in the Tosco versus Coke Corporation, that CERCLA often involves historical facts. And CERCLA, you can find liability based upon circumstantial evidence, because you're talking about things, in that case, it was in the 1940s. Here it's in the 19 teens and 1920s. There are no live witnesses around, but you can infer that. And Judge Egan had a full record made to her on all of these issues. She made findings, systematic findings of fact on the bench trial, and she made a number of findings in connection with the issues for piercing the corporate veil in her summary judgment. And if I can just take 10 seconds to just talk about that, she had every piece of information in front of her that she would have if she had a bench trial on the piercing the corporate veil. And she considered it and ruled that and made findings of fact and exercised an equitable principle. And equitable principles under this court's law are reviewed on whether or not there's a presumed correctiveness to it when it's a mixed question of law. And equitable principles can be reviewed on an abuse of discretion, clear error standard. So those, and there's a lot in the briefs about that, but I do want to say, just as the last thing is, even if you decide to apply, which I don't think you should apply, I think you can apply the clear error standard, but even if you review this de novo, I submit this is a case that you should affirm. And if you don't affirm it, you're just emboldening a party to evade its CERCLA obligations. Thank you.
All right. Judge Briscoe, do you have any further questions?
No, I don't. Thank you.
Judge Rossman, would you like to ask anything else?
No, thank you.
Okay. Counsel, thank you for your excellent arguments today. The case will be submitted and counsel are excused.